Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Blog Talk Radio Shedding Light. I'm your host, Lawrence Drink, a.k.a. Sparky Lee. You can find me on legacyprograms.net, as well as Sparky Lee from Georgia on Facebook. We are all over the spectrum, LinkedIn. You'll find us there. So one of the questions that were brought up last week, I got an email from somebody, and they wanted us to elaborate a little bit more on resources that are available and realistic reentry. Not no crap where it's like, oh, hey, we're going to teach you how to balance a checkbook, and then you get out and you got to operate a phone. And then for some people, you know, like for instance, they tell you, go get a vocation. You go get a vocation. And then you come out and parole says that you cannot do that vocation. So what did you disinvest your time and energy and effort into? So today we're gonna kind of go back and forth, me and Sean, about what's going on with parole. And for anybody that has questions or comments, please feel free to email me at lawrencedrink@gmail.com or legacyprograms.education@gmail.com. And drop a comment, leave a question. We will address it the following week. And please feel free to call in and, you know, leave a comment, ask a question, and let's see if we can get some education and awareness out there. All right. Sean, how you doing today, man?
You know, all things considering, I'm not doing too bad. You know how it is, another week on parole, another stupid rule. And this week was no exception. But other than that, I'm doing pretty good. Yourself?
I can't complain. You know, I just had a buddy of mine get off parole. This man had a double life sentence, ended up getting out, and he got off parole within a year and 3 months. So real proud of him.
Okay.
And the funny thing is we're doing the same exact program. In fact, I'm probably doing a little bit more. So, always love being discriminated against in the parole, you know, community. But as we all know, I am worth $92,000 a year. So, they're definitely not going to get rid of me. And they don't have to feed or clothe me or provide anything for me, especially resources. They don't have to go out and find me a job. They don't have to buy me clothes. I do all that myself. So, you know that, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I do. It's all about the money. It's as much as we wish it weren't, it's all about the money.
Absolutely. So with the resources,
you were mentioning about resources. Yes.
Yeah. What resources do you have right now?
Well, they like to paint this picture about how we have all these resources that are available to us. But the matter is, they really don't. In my situation, a little bit different than other individuals because I have some medical conditions that, in theory, expand the resources that are available to me. But those resources are not provided by CDC. The only thing the CDC did for me, they put me up in a motel room for 2 weeks, and then they paid my rent in the trailer park that I'm living in for 2 weeks. And they did not do this because I was eligible for a resource. They did it because the judge had picked up the phone and made a phone call to them and made this big issue or whatever, not in an attempt to help me, quite the contrary, but either which way, the judge had gotten involved, and because the judge's involvement, CDC went a little bit above and beyond. Actually, when he came up last time.
So, a quick question, I'm sorry. How did you go about that to get the judge involved for the people out there that are having issues?
Well, so in my particular situation, the judge got involved because the prosecution filed a motion to abandon the petition to commit me, and the judge was not having it. He was not happy with it. He did not like the idea. He tried to talk the prosecution into not dismissing the petition, and he knew that wasn't going to work, but it's election year. He was only doing that to try to make himself look good for the public. But then what he did was he picked up the phone and he called my PO, and it was not an attempt to help me out. It was more of an attempt to make absolutely positively certain that, you know, this individual that's being released to society is going to be supervised, and we are going to not only supervise him, we are going to supervise him with a microscope. It was one of those kinds of phone calls. But generally speaking, there really aren't any resources. 19 years in prison. I got out. I'm labeled as a high-risk parolee, and my parole officer told me that there were not any resources for me as far as paying the rent, but that he was able to get the resources he did for 4 weeks because he basically, in his words, not mine, he begged and pleaded for the resources to help me out. One thing that he did give me that was a resource was a bus pass. And the bus pass, and this cracks me up because rather than coming up with a way to do it inexpensively, they're paying full price for the bus pass. So he's given me these $10 bus passes, but they're only to be used for parole appointments, to be used for me to go from my current location, which is, you know, approximately eight miles away from an actual grocery store. I'm in the middle of nowhere. So I can't use it to go to the grocery store, to go to medical or anything like that. I can only use it for the parole outpatient clinic or the POC, my parole here or my appointments with my parole officer, et cetera. Other than that, their idea of resources was the same resources that are available to anybody else in the community. They literally have a packet of information that you can get from 211 or different websites or whatever. As a matter of fact, you can go out to the Social Services Office and get a copy of the very same resources. Help with housing and everything else. But, of course, as anybody who's on parole knows, a lot of those are not available to you because you're on so on and so forth.
Yeah. Ending a felony, I think like even Section 8 doesn't accept anybody with a felony.
Any felony, like they're a little bit more, they're a little bit looser. I want to say it's drug offenses, certain, like any offenses involving bombs or something like that, any offenses involving welfare fraud, any sex offenses. There is a list. You're correct. There is a list, but it's not any and all felonies. But it's pretty close. And there's supposed to be changes by the way, they were talking about.
Well, I had a conversation with somebody in prison 2 days ago about the resources that are available. And there's this list of this myth. I'm going around, it's like 3 pages of resources. And they say, well, parole will buy you clothes. They'll buy you clothes and give you so much money. You know what I'm talking about. That package that's been put down since the 70s. That's been photocopied so many times that you can barely read it. And so I had to debunk his statement and say, no, it's absolutely BS of what they're passing around right now. So these guys are getting out. They think that they're going to get on Social Security. A lot of long-termers are talking about PTSD. You know, they can't work in the workforce. Well, fortunately for me, my wife works for the county and knows the ins and outs of the Social Security office, and she says that it's crap. You know, it's a 2-year process. This is what I've just learned. It's a 2-year process, and you have to be physically disabled, like to the point where a doctor signs off on it. And right now the doctors really aren't signing off and saying, hey, you're permanently disabled. You're permanently blind. And PTSD, for the people listening, does not qualify. You're still able to work. And how they're going to justify that is they're going to say, hey, go take some pills, you know, go see the psych, go get some therapy. So this is the thing. So I had a similar situation when we were evacuated. Parole would not let me go stay with our aunt, my wife's aunt, for the evacuation. They said it was too far. So they said, well, we'll house you up here in Reading. And let me tell you, Reading's a straight shithole. I'm sorry for anyone listening from Reading. There's no disrespect to you, but your county's a straight shithole. It's you walk the streets and it's full of nothing but homelessness and drug addicts. That's all there is up north in that town. And so parole sits there and gives us this motel room for a couple weeks, and they're doing it 3 days at a time because they have to sign off. You know, they have to get special permission, anything over like $500 or something like that. And we were getting gouged. You know, for $50 a night, it was the best value in Reading, and it was garbage. And normally they it's $40 a night, $50 a night. They were charging $160. Maybe it was because we were on parole. Maybe because they were gouging because they know the motels were scarce at the time. Who knows?
It wasn't that sparky. When I got out, I went to the motel literally across the street from the jail in the parking office of the parole office, and they paid $1,300 and some for me to stay there for 14 days. And I went and I talked to all my neighbors. They were all paying half of what parole was paying for me to stay there. And they paid it 2 weeks ahead of time. Like, you know what I mean? They paid it, here's a two-week chunk. Here's a check for $1,300 to cover 2 weeks. And no discount, nothing like that. And then I moved out here, and here it was $300 a week, which was a big difference. You know, and I was able to get my current landlord to reduce that even further once I started paying it. Now I'm down to $700 a month. But they don't care. They sit there, they spend this money, and then they sit there and they complain to you about, well, because he told me, he says, we've already spent, you know, almost $2,000 on you to get a place to stay. And all I could think of was, okay, I've been gone for a long time, but $2,000 is actually pretty cheap compared to what I'm hearing.
Yeah, no, it was, but the motel room that they gave us was the worst of the worst. I mean, this had holes in the floor, divots. I mean, it was horrible. And we had, you know, five cats. We had a dog. I had my son and me and my wife. So, and they did us no favors. Broke a refrigerator. Go ask them for another one. They griped about that. It was just a horrible place to go. So don't go to Best Buy Inn. There's a plug for you guys. And they don't leave a light on for you. So what ended up happening was, 2 weeks into it, they were like saying, hey, you know, you guys need to figure something out. And we told them, look, my wife's not working. I'm not working. We're evacuated. So parole's going to have to pick up the tab. Parole tried backing out of it. I think a week into the before we got out, we left midweek, and so the parole's like, "Hey, we can't pay for this no more, and we'll send you to a clean and sober living home, and your wife and your son can send for themselves, pretty much." And
what is the deal with the clean and sober living home?
And they wanted to send me to Oroville.
They want to send everybody there.
Like,
why? Like, I don't have any history of drugs. Why do they keep trying to send me there?
Because they're funded, they get money, and they have like a contract with parole. And plus, it's a meth capital of the United States. So, like, why not? I mean, you can't even. You could find meth over there faster than you could find a full set of teeth. So it's pretty bad. And their clean and sober living home is like square in the middle of a freaking drug ring. It's ridiculous. Like, you know, everyone that goes there relapses. But they do that on purpose. That's all by design. So they tried to send me there. I refused. I made a phone call to Sacramento. Fortunately, I work with other organizations, and Bernard, a friend of mine and mentor, you know, directed me to this, and I called. And I said, hey, listen, you guys are responsible for me. You guys are responsible for me as the state of California while I'm on parole, right? And they said, absolutely. And I said, are you aware of what's going on, that you guys are going to put my family homeless? And they sit there and they said, don't worry about it. We're going to make a phone call. They make a phone call. The supervisor of my parole office calls me and says, hey, I could speak about this now because he's retired. But he calls me directly and says, hey, I don't appreciate what you did. You know, we are in the business of taking care of you, not your family. And that really rubbed me the wrong way. You know, I was like, my family, huh? So you're going to split me up, send me to, you know, in the middle of nowhere with a bunch of drugs in a clean, sober living home, take a resource from somebody else that absolutely needs it, where I don't have a drug or alcohol history, and you're going to just stick me here until I go back home. No. So, you know, I got pushed off, and he retaliated against me. I was up for less supervision, and they denied it. They said, no, we want to see 6 more months of programming before we lower it. But I was eligible at that point. And that was a year after a year in. So, because as we know, they review it every 3-6 months, whatever it is. So I was eligible. They lashed out. But let me tell you something, the resources. This is what people don't know. They say, oh, no, this program over here. And I'm not even going to mention the program's name. But I went to this program where they offer hygiene, food, vouchers, bus passes, everything. I go there and I ask. And they say, well, give us your name and number, and we'll, you know, and your parole officer's name. Give the parole officer's name, go through that. You know, the parole officer has to email them, and it, like, it was a full-on freak show. I didn't understand it. They were sending me left, right, and I kept calling my parole officer. And you know how hard it is to get a hold of a parole officer. Like, damn near impossible. And so I'm texting her, and I'm like, hey, did you send that email? And she goes, yeah, I sent it. And then I call the place, and I go, she emailed you. Oh, but we haven't gotten it yet. And last time I checked, an email went directly through, unless your Wi-Fi is really slow. So come to find out, I found out from one of the workers there that I was denied because, funny story, I'm in the county of commitment. I have a history since 9 years old. And 8 years old, actually, from getting locked up in juvenile hall and committing crimes and raising hell in that town. The sheriff's department was the one doing the screening process for that program. So they sat there and said, nope, we're not helping them. So I was denied clothes. I was denied hygiene. I was denied food. Anything that was going to help me. Then I sit there and I go to the work, you know, the Alliance of the Workforce over there. And they're giving me the runaround saying, we don't have the funding. Come to find out, they did have the funding. Once again, I was discriminated against, and they said, nope, we can't help you. But they can't come out right and say it. So a lot of you guys that are out there, women, you know, going through your process and you're getting the runaround, it's normally 9 out of 10 times you're denied. And but they can't flat out say, hey, we don't like you, we don't want you. Nope, they can't say that. Because it's discrimination at its finest. And, you know, and you just sit there and you have to, like, oh, well, and your parole officer can't tell you, and they can't tell you, so they're giving you this full runaround story, and you're running around with your like a chicken with its head cut off, trying to figure out what am I going to do for your basic needs. And the county, whoever's, so find out who's doing the screening process. A lot of times, just because these programs are available doesn't mean they're available to you. Yeah, somebody could be having a bad day, and they're going to deny you. But they're not going to flat out tell you so you can go find something else. They're going to let you hang on. They're going to sit there and eat your hopes up and be like, well, talk to your parole officer again. Talk to your parole officer again. You get another, it just buys another 2 weeks. So that was what I went through. The resources are available. When I was released, I asked the parole officer, I said, well, hey, I'm homeless. I'm in a county of commitment. I haven't been here since I was 16 years old. I have no family over here. I can't, you know, I any family I do have, they're toxic. And so they, you know, he pretty much told me, well, you can live under a bridge. Oh, okay. Well, I just need a motel room for a couple weeks to get on my feet. Now, mind you, I was released with no ID, no birth certificate, no Social Security card. I had nothing. And in fact, when I went for my birth certificate, I didn't exist in the program or in the system because I was gone for so long. When I went for my ID, I got to run around on that. Well, you need your birth certificate in order to get your ID. You need your ID in order to get your birth certificate. It made no sense at all. And then when you sit there and you pay the money to go to the county you were born in and get your stuff, it takes about 4 weeks to get that. So this whole time, I'm, you know, parole's telling me, go out there, get a job. Go out there, find housing. Go out there and be a productive member of society. But in fact, there was no resources to assist that. And what, and everybody knows, what can you do without an ID? Sean, enlighten me. What can you do without an ID?
You can't, legally, you can't even walk down the street. Legally,
so,
you're
like
not
allowed
to walk down the street.
Yeah, no. Well, they tell you, keep your ID on you at all times. It is a parole violation. But, hey, if you're on parole and we don't give it to you, you're good. So, like, there's these double standards with parole with how they release us and stuff like that. A lot of the homelessness that I've experienced with people, most of them are formerly incarcerated with no resources. And so that parole promotes, they tell you to go live under a bridge. Last time I checked, that's illegal. I believe it's squatting, loitering, and there's, you know, the list goes on. But the resources, you know, everyone says, well, parole will give you food vouchers, bus passes. I cried in my parole office, and I said, I have nothing. What do you want me to do? I told him, just send me back to prison. Oh, well, we can't do that. You have to actually go out and commit another crime. Oh, okay. So this is how parole works, folks. Like, just so you think that, oh, well, these guys have all the resources. We have nothing. The only resources, I provide more resources for my guys in my program than what parole has provided me for. And let me tell you, I don't have to do much. I stay here and I work 10 to 12 hours a day. Out of that portion of my money, I make sure, you know, my clients have, you know, what they need. But other than that, like, I can do more with less than what they're doing. And they have these available. They just choose not to. So, Sean, what resources were available to you?
Well, I had CalFresh and Medi-Cal, but they weren't provided by parole. And the problem that I'm having now is my parole officer would not let me get a job when I first got out. He kept telling me that everything I was trying to do was something that I could not do.
So did they give you money?
Home after the pool. He did pay for my rent in the motel that I was staying in. That was for a month.
For how
and
long
then he came to me 3 weeks into it. There was the 2 weeks at the motel, the 2 weeks here in the trailer park. And he comes up to me at the beginning of my second week here in the trailer park. I should say RV park. I'm sorry. The RV park. And he goes, we're not paying your rent anymore. And I says, well, what am I supposed to do? Not my problem. Well, I don't have a job. You won't let me get a job. Of course, I'm not saying it this way because, you know, they're the parole officer. They're the ones with all the power. But I'm basically letting him know that he's put me in between this rock and a hard place. You want me to pay my rent, and yet I'm not allowed to work. What am I supposed to do? But that wasn't quite enough. Now he's sitting here telling me that my residence is not approved. Well, you not only did you approve me to stay here, you paid my rent to stay here, not once. So,
yeah.
Resources?
So what's going through your mind at that point? Like,
but I'm about
like,
to lose those.
So, when you're going through that process, when he's telling you you can't, like, you got to leave, what's going through your head? I mean, just for people out there that don't understand the mind of the formerly incarcerated, what was your thought process, your coping mechanisms for that?
So there are a couple things. The first one is there's this overwhelming terror of going back to prison, especially in my situation. I've been in trouble so many times. If I go back to jail, that's it. It's done. It's over with. For the rest of my life, I'm going to be in prison. So there's that. There's the overwhelming frustration because I am literally doing everything under the sun to do the right thing simply to stay out of trouble, but to become a productive member of society, a taxpaying member of society, a positively contributing constructive member of society. You know what I mean? And every single time I try to do something, he steps in my way and he puts his foot on my neck.
How many jobs
a little
were
bit
denied?
With that?
How many? Because I got a question. How many jobs were you denied? Because if he's telling you can't work and that they're not going to pay for your housing or for any other resources, like, what's the other option? Like, did he give you another option? Did he say, well, you can go out and be a gigolo or
said it wasn't
like
problem.
A stripper?
He literally
nothing.
Yeah, he literally said it wasn't his problem.
Wow. But yeah, you are the property of CDCR still. Under parole, you are still, they're still getting money for you. So where's that money going? What resources are available? This is I don't even know.
I have my suspicions because there's just no way, and I'm getting the $92,000 figure I get from you, but there's just no way that this program should be taking in $92,000 a year to sit there with me twice a week with seven other guys for an hour and a half. So that's eight guys times $92,000 a year.
Let me tell you a fun fact. So in the program that I'm part of, they pay, if you have a regular degree, just an AA, you get $15 an hour, minimum wage for these counselors. If you have a master's, you get $17 an hour. Where's the money at? How, if you're paying these counselors this much, and you can, and this is public knowledge, folks, all you got to do is go to New Beginnings in Chico.
Well,
and
I
look
can tell you right
account.
Now that my counselor does not have a master's degree. My counselor is a former probation officer. As a matter of fact, I believe, and I have not been able to confirm this, but I believe that my counselor was the probation officer of one of the witnesses in my case.
Oh. That sounds like a call.
One of the people that accused me in my case, I believe that he was involved in supervising their probation.
Yeah.
Well,
of course they hide stuff, and you can't even confirm it. It's not public knowledge. They're gonna hide that, that's confidential information. Why? No, absolutely not. It shouldn't be. I just want to know where this money's going. If we're worth $92,000, where we're not being housed, clothed, or fed, why are they getting funding for anybody? Why is parole getting funding to take care of us if they're not taking care of us? Now, if I'm wrong, like, I could be completely wrong about this. You there?
Yeah, I'm here. I was just sitting
here
thinking when you were talking about where the money was going. I was sitting here thinking,
yeah,
have you ever went down to the parole office and watched these guys drive their cars in?
Oh, all the time. They're driving.
Yeah, they're
do you know?
They're all driving.
You know what kind of cars are? Yeah, they're driving $60,000 trucks. I mean, at least in my area, they are. And of course, you got to be safe.
One of them
drove, but I
was sitting and looking at the vehicles, and they were nice trucks. They were $40,000, $60,000 trucks. You know, and I'm not saying you can't afford that on a CDC salary, because clearly you can. But when we talk about where the money is going, well, it's clearly going to everybody who works for CDC or works with CDC, but it is not going into, and I don't want to say into the pockets, but for lack of a better term, it's not going into the pockets of the individuals who are on parole, because realistically speaking, they could have set me up with a decent place to stay and everything else. They spent $1,300 plus another $600. They spent almost $2,000 in the space of a month. And I told them from day one, I said, I have a travel trailer. It is being brought up, but they wanted to put me in this motel. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. The travel trailer came up. I'm like, dude, I got a travel trailer. But they did not want to pay for the monthly rate. They wanted me to get there, 1 week at a time. They waste money. It's not their money. They don't care. They waste money. I never would have spent money the way that they spent money. And my supporters and I, we argued about this for almost 2 years. We argued about this. And I told her, I said, listen, I want a travel trailer. Why do you want a travel trailer? Because a travel trailer is inexpensive. Yes, there's going to be issues with it and everything else, but it's inexpensive. If I don't like my neighbors, I can leave. If my parole officer doesn't like where I'm staying at, I can leave. Like, I can leave at the drop of a hat, and I'm not out of however much money I'm spending on a lease. Now, imagine for a moment, had I actually gotten an apartment or a house, even worse. I got a house. Let's say I got a two-bedroom house. I'm paying $3,000-$4,000 a month for rent. I signed a 1 year lease because my parole officer said I could stay here. And then he comes in and he tells me, yep, you know what? I made a mistake. You're 60 feet inside of the exclusion zone. You need to move. Well, wait a minute. You approved me. This is not my problem. Okay, so now I'm out $4,000 a month times 12 months because the landlord can legally hold me to that lease. That's $48,000. Right off the top, plus the first month's rent, or the security deposit and everything else. So I would be screwed. That's why I went with the travel trailer. Because with the travel trailer, I don't have the money to move it, and he wants me to move it. I legitimately do not have the money. Don't have the money to fix the flat tire, but still an easier situation to deal with than had I had to cancel a lease on an apartment.
Yeah.
And that's,
unfortunately,
that's what I'm
when
talking
we talk about
like,
programs, what's that?
Well, like realistic reentry. You know, what is realistic and what is myth and what is fable? Like, you know, they act like, you know, they're helping us. And the society sits there and goes, well, when we fail, it's because the person failed. No, the parolee was failed. That's how it is.
Here's a perfect example, Sparky. You already know this because you're in my you know what I'm going through. Here's a perfect example. 5 minutes, I could be a productive, constructive member of society. It only takes one word from him. Yes. The problem is, I need access to a computer to do my business. And you already know my business. I'm a paralegal. I work with attorneys throughout the state. I work with a bunch of clients throughout the state that need help on different things. I have clients right now backed up out of the door that want to hire, you know, people that I can legitimately, genuinely help out. But my parole officer doesn't want me touching a computer, even though I did not use a computer to commit a crime. So I filed a grievance on it. The grievance based out there says, no, you can use the computer at the law library. You don't need a computer in your house. Okay, well, first of all,
I got a question.
Broken me aside.
You're super.
What's that?
Oh, hold on. The grievance process is supposed to go through your agent to the supervisor. But if I'm not mistaken, isn't it your parole officer or the supervisor?
Yeah, my parole officer is the supervisor. Yes.
Oh, so the buck stops there. Like there's no process. It's a yes or a no.
You know, I'm looking at the grievance because you got me curious. Now I'm trying to figure out. No, it wasn't him who signed it. It was somebody else. Somebody named Caraway. But the grievance, by the way, so I wrote a grievance because the records that they're relying upon are 100% inaccurate. The judge already said so in court. End of story. They choose to rely on the record anyway. They didn't even have the audacity. They didn't have the nerve, the decency, whatever you want to call it. They did not even attempt to interview me, even though I called them every 2 days. I called and called and called and called and called. The phone was always 100%, never answered one time for the appeal, for the person who does the appeals. The voicemail box was 100% full 100% of the time. When I did get a hold of other people through other channels, they sat there and said, there's nothing we could do. We don't do it, blah, blah, blah. And then there were other people that sat there and heard my story, and they were incensed by what was going on. They're like, that's not what's supposed to be happening. If I had a parolee that came to me and said that he was willing to let someone monitor his computer, I would have done it in a heartbeat. You know, he has the discretion to do this, to do that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I talk to my parolee, his first question is, well, who told you this? Well, I'm not going to sit there and tell you that, because if I do that, then I just shot myself in the foot by taking away somebody who was trying to support, you know, stand in my corner. But, I started this show off by saying that another week, another rule. I had friends come up with that.
No, absolutely. They do that with me.
Yeah,
I had friends come
all the way up to see me from Woodland, California, spent the weekend up here, had a great time, went to see a movie, didn't think anything of it, and his he tracked me down. I'm in town shopping for parts to fix my bike, and he tracks me down. And he says, he hands me the response to the grievance, and I follow him outside, and he goes, and I thought he was being cordial. He goes, well, how was your weekend? And I was like, it was pretty good. He goes, what movie did you go to see? And I said, I went to see Top Gun Maverick. And he goes, and I'm thinking, you know, we're going to have a real live person conversation, not like a, you know, I'm the boss and you're the whatever. And he's like, no, don't do that again. And I go, do what? And he goes, don't go see a movie again without my permission. See a movie without my permission because the movie theater has an arcade in it. No, the movie theater doesn't have an arcade in it. It has two arcade games. How does that have anything to do with my offense? Nothing. No way, shape, or form is there a nexus. But these terms and conditions every week get stricter and stricter. He made me go in, and I've already registered twice. He made me register a third time. Actually, let me back up a little bit. The second time I registered, I leave, and he calls me up and tells me, basically, he texts me and says that the registration wasn't good enough. I need to go do it again. And I just did it a couple minutes ago. I'm like, why? He goes, well, you didn't put down your permit number. So I sent him a screenshot the paperwork.
I have a question.
Sure.
How demeaning is it to register? Walk me through that process. Well, because this is the thing. I want to paint a picture for people listening. Now, for you doing everything you're supposed to, you're trying to get a job, you're trying to remain free. You're dealing with a lot of post-traumatic stress syndrome as well. But going in, what is the registry? Like, what are you going through in there? Like, how do they treat you?
Oh, when you go to register?
Yeah.
Well, believe it or not, it wasn't too bad. I went into Eureka. The paperwork was already filled out. I just needed to sign it. That was a police department. When I went to the sheriff's department, I had to fill out all the paperwork myself. It was a little bit stressful because, like, if you forget something, you run the risk of going to prison for the rest of your life, and you're struggling to remember everything, to put everything down. Did I ever have an alias, whatever the case may be? And you're doing this with other people in there, complete strangers doing their business, and they hear that you're registering, start getting these dirty looks and everything else. You know what I mean? And your stress starts to go up, you know, through the roof, and you know, it gets really frustrating. And then I get done and I leave, and I get a text saying, go do it again. I'm like, why? And he goes, well, because you didn't put your apartment number down. No, I did put it down. Here's a screenshot of the paper. And he's not happy. He says, well, you might have to go back. No, I don't might have to do anything. I'm putting my foot down. I did what I was supposed to do. Here's the paperwork. It's proven. It's done. If they did not do that, that's on them. That's not on me. I did my job, and I have proof of it. That's all that I need. And then all of a sudden, mysteriously, a couple weeks later, I go in for the containment team meeting, which that should be a warning to anybody that's going through these proceedings or listening to these proceedings. Why do we call it a containment? I go to this meeting, and he tells me, they all tell me, you got to go re-register. I says, for what? He goes, because you did not put down an alias. What alias? And they give me an alias, Gino, from 25 years ago. I'm like, that was on the original registration paperwork. He goes, I know it was, but you need to put it on the updated paperwork. Why do I need to put it on the updated paperwork if it was on the original paperwork? When I go to register, I don't give you every single address I've ever lived in. I give you the current address. Have I went by Gino in 20 years? No, I haven't, so I didn't put it down. I went to re-register per my instructions, and I did this to be a smartass, but I also did it because I was trying to show him how serious I was taking this. I registered 10 minutes later, and when I walked in the office, the lady looks at me and says, what are you doing? Did you move? I says, no. She goes, you registered permanently. I says, yes, ma'am. Well, what are you here for? I'm here for because my probation updated registration paperwork. I have to put an alias that was on the original paperwork from 25 years ago. And she was blown away. She goes, no, you don't. I said, I'm just telling you what he told me to do. So she calls him, but she's so upset, she calls him up. But, you know, she works for law enforcement, as does he, so at the end of the day, she took his side. I'm not surprised. It is what it is. I'm not, you know, Sparky, you and I both know how the game is played. So they make the rules. They change the rules.
Well,
all we can do is try to figure out the rules and follow it.
And this is the thing. It is in their best interest. Like, let's just throw out the facts here. I don't know the ratio between parolees and parole agents, but I do know they're outnumbered. Like, my parole officer takes care of the whole county. Actually, like, three counties. Plumas, Lassen, and Redding up there somewhere. So, like, the thing is that if they can get you off the caseload, oh, that's great for them. It's less work. The other thing is that, you know, we have to remember that parole and CDCR is one entity. You know, it is in their best interest to keep us locked up, to keep the cash cow, you know, alive and kicking, you know, without spending as much money. So, yeah, if dude, if you end up going back to prison, you know, that you're worth $100,000 up to, and your warehouse, and they're still getting money for you. It doesn't matter if you're on parole, if you're inside, they're getting money for you. $100,000 a year up to, you know, per parole.
Do your listeners know how much our parole has? I mean,
they can let you do whatever they want.
Not just the fact that you could be out there doing what you want to be doing the way you're supposed to be doing it and still have somebody come up and say, you know what, I don't like the color pants you got on. I'm violating you for 10 days. It's called a 10-day flash. But no, I mean,
yep.
I get out. I was given 3 years parole by the judge. And I get out, and parole tells me, yeah, you're going to do 5 years on parole. I wasn't sentenced to 5 years. I was sentenced to 3 years on parole. And you're going to take it upon yourself to change the terms and conditions of my sentence? And there's
that's $200,000, of course.
Yeah, that's pretty much a side of it. It's all about the money.
And let me tell you something about the program. I'm just going to speak on New Beginnings now. I don't care because I absolutely disagree with this program. For $92,000 a year, folks, this is what you get. You get a TED Talks. They're going to sit there on Telemed and let you listen to TED Talk. They have no set.
Not in my group.
Okay,
not in my group.
Beginnings here. There is no set curriculum. There is a check-in that's going to last at least 45 minutes amongst four people, maybe three, and if nobody else shows up, too. So that's what this program is being paid for, you know, for doing absolutely nothing, the bare minimum of providing resources. And let me tell you something. So one guy was sitting there having issues with something. I offer my resources for my program because, fortunately for me, I run not just a successful reentry program, but also a sex offender program. They're using and they want they're adopting my curriculum as we speak. You know, when I speak, they write notes and they're like, "Oh, that's really good." Curriculum that I wrote, by the way. So this is how this is working, is that this program is they have no vision in sight of letting anybody go. They have no vision of rehabilitation, and there's no therapy. A check-in is five simple questions, and yet it's for 45 minutes. For an hour and a half, you have to attend these groups. But they're not giving nothing. But this guy was having an issue with a resume. I said, well, hey, you know, I could have my secretary help you out with that resume. How about that? And the lady in the program sat there and told me, no, you can't do that. You're not supposed to be talking to other parolees. And I said, excuse me, ma'am, but I actually have permission to talk to other parolees. I run a reentry program. My business is, you know, parolees. That's my focus. And so she sat there and she's like, well, no, you can't offer your services. I said, oh, okay. I said, what services do you provide? Are you going to help them with the resume? She goes, no, we don't provide that. But yes, in the same breath, you're going to call this a support group. You know, I understand we're not supposed to be hanging out, but at the same time, you're going through my organization, not through me. I'm just providing the service that we provide. So, you know, that was my issue where I went head-to-head with this program, and I said, but now it's okay. Now I can sit there
I have a similar story. I have a similar story, right?
Yeah.
I go in the group last week. I go on Mondays and Wednesdays, and on Monday I go in there and they're doing the check-in. And it's basically like your feelings, you know, why you're feeling that way, so on and so forth. And the guy, he starts talking about how things got so bad in his living environment, he actually called the police to turn himself in, right, because he didn't want to get into any trouble. And during the check-in, he talks about how bad things still are. And then we just go to the next guy, and I says, whoa, I says, can I ask a question? Now, mind you, this is my first group. Let me rephrase that. This is my first group in this program. I went to the groups like before I went to prison and everything else. This is my first group in this program after getting out. And the facilitator says, well, we don't normally do that, but, well, I guess. And I'm like, okay, good. To me, I just heard a bunch of red flags. Like, we should have stopped what we were doing and helped this man out. And I looked at the guy, and I says, well, let me ask you a question. I says, do you have any – because clearly you don't have any support groups. support people, people that you can turn to. And he goes, no, I don't. I says, why not? I says, how long have you been in the program? And what about these guys here? And he goes, I can't turn to the guys in the program because we're not allowed to talk to each other outside of group. And I said, so let me get this straight. Imagine for a moment that we're all alcoholics. And who does an alcoholic go to? Somebody who's not in the program, somebody who just started the program, or somebody who's farther in the program than he is? And he goes, well, that makes sense. I should go to another alcoholic who's farther along in the program than I am. I said, exactly. I said, but we're not allowed to. That doesn't make any sense. So we're sitting here talking, and the facilitator wants to move it along to the next person. And we get done, and an hour later, the facilitator says, 5 minutes left, and he goes, well, now that everybody's checked in and now that we've done all this, that, and the other, let's check in with these two people over here because they have some really serious problems we need to talk about. You think the man was sitting there telling you he's got red flags and he needs help, and you did not want to help that person. Instead, you wanted to hand everybody a workbook and say, read pages 1 through 39. Seriously? What the heck is this? This isn't treatment. This is a freaking sham.
Yeah.
But I sat there and I didn't say anything. And I looked at the guy, and when we got done with the check-in and everyone's sitting there talking, I looked over at him and I said, hey, listen, dude. And I started giving him help. I'm giving him advice. I'm like, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I said, because there's only two options out of here. Option number one, she's going to call the police on you and you're going to go to jail. Option number two, you're going to get evicted because you guys can't stop fussing and fighting with each other, or she can't stop fussing and fighting with the neighbors. And what happens? One of the idiots in group pops up, says, well, maybe you guys should go to therapy. That's the third. And I'm like, no, dude, listen, you've been with this woman per your own story. You got with this woman because you just got out of prison. You were lonely and desperate and wanted to be with someone. You didn't care who it was. That's not the kind of person you want to do therapy with. You need to get yourself out of that poison situation, because that is only going to bring, and this guy is steadily talking about, go do couples counseling and blah, blah, blah. Not the facilitator, but he was co-signing it. And I'm sitting there looking, I'm like, this is not what treatment is. So I write down the name of the book that we're working out of, and I can't remember the name of the book now. But anyway, I give it to my friend who does this kind of stuff, and she looks it up, because I can't access the internet. She looks it up, and she comes back, and she goes, this is not for sex offenders. This is a drug treat manual for drug offenders. And I'm like, are you serious?
Yeah.
She goes, yeah. And she showed me. She pulled out the thing and showed it to me. She goes, here's a drug treatment one. Here's the SO1. You are doing the drug treatment one. So Wednesday, I go back to group, and I brought this up. And they look at me like I'm crazy. Like they don't know if they want to shoot me because I figured out the dirty little secret, or if they want to deny it. And I started pushing the issue. I said, no. I recognized the book, and I kind of did, because I did work through the book before. I just didn't realize it was exclusively for drug or whatever, because it was so long ago. And, we just build off of it. And I'm like, if I'm in an SOTP program, should I not be doing SOTP things? But to their credit, and I will say this, the woman who owns the program, who recently sold the program, we started talking, and I told her. I said, look, I have a relapse prevention plan. And she looked at me like, what? I'm like, yeah, I've been doing treatment for years. I just got out of prison. I have to go to you. You're the first time I've seen you. But I've been doing program treatment, whatnot, for years. And I told her what I did. I told her I did a 12-step program for sex and love addicts. And she actually, you know, said, yeah, that's actually a decent program. I'll put you in touch with somebody, see if he's still doing the program in the neighborhood. And I was like, okay, this is not the person I remember, because I had her 19 years ago when I got in trouble. And I was very bitter about the fact that I was in her program, because she could have came forward 19 years ago and she could have clarified a lot of stuff, and she did it. And I had a lot of bitterness towards me for her. I was really shocked when she did that. Not just the fact that she was listening to what I had to say. We talked about the Static 99, how inaccurate it was. And I think she was surprised that I knew as much as I did. But again, you know this, Sparky, I take my treatment seriously, you know. And I was impressed, because she actually, unlike a lot of people, like the containment team meeting, they're like, oh, SAA and SLAA and SA, that's not treatment. Like, why is it not treatment? Does it help you become a better person? Yes. Therefore, it's treatment. I don't care if it's
yep.
what I'm going through isn't taught by a doctor with a bachelor's degree. It's taught by, you know, a local individual who has maybe, I'm sorry, I said bachelor, I meant master's degree. It's taught by some local guy who at most has a bachelor's degree in psychology. You know, if that, he's a licensed clinical social worker. And I'm not knocking it. I'm just pointing out that, you know, treatment is what you make of it. You can get treatment by going outside and meditating, you know, if you take it seriously. But,
yeah.
Sorry, I get worked up on that, man. When you made the comment about what you were going through, I get really worked up because I take my treatment seriously. You know, I might not, when I go into my groups, I might be combative and everything else. At least that's how they put it down on paper. But I do that because I take it seriously. I do that because I don't understand and I want to know, you know. And when we had the meeting this week, I told them, you know, my biggest problem all throughout history, my biggest problem was understanding the power differential. And she was just,
yeah.
What are you talking about? And I explained it to her, you know. And once I got past that, it's like I had put this whole puzzle together, but I had this one piece missing, and I couldn't figure out what the puzzle was until I put it in. When I put that last piece in the puzzle, I seen everything crystal clearly the way it was meant to be seen. Everything fell into place, you know. And once that piece of the puzzle got put together, I realized whether I intended on it or not, I took advantage of people. And everything changed in that instant because now I got it. Now I know how I hurt people. And I didn't see it then because I thought we were all out there partying, having a good time, I thought. And we were at the time. But what I did not know was I was planting poisonous seeds. And even though I could not see the fruit they were bearing, and it might not be for years, but at some point in time, that seed was going to take root. And when it took root, it was going to bear poisonous fruit. And
yeah.
when I finally understood that, everything clicked. There was no more excuses, no more nothing. I got it, you know. So when you
yeah.
talk about that, I get frustrated because I'm like, there are a lot of people such as yourself that are trying to do good, and these rules and regulations are set up to sit there and tell you and myself, you cannot use your knowledge, your skills, your expertise, you can't use it to help someone else out. You cannot use it to stop someone else from getting into trouble. You cannot use it
yeah.
to stop someone from being hurt. And I sent my parole,
well,
and here's a good example.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No.
So here's a really good example. The other day, last week, we're having a barbecue, and I look over, and there's smoke, and we're talking about the fire that's like a couple miles away. And I go to close the laundry room because it's part of my job. I go to close the laundry room, and as I'm walking, one of my neighbors says, "Dude, there's a fire." I'm like, "No, it's you know, it's way over there." She's like, no, right there, look. And I turn around and look, and there's huge plumes of smoke billowing up. And I couldn't even go on her property to help put out the fire.
Yeah.
Because the terms and conditions,
well,
my parole say, I am not allowed to go on someone's property. That
well, this
is
my
extreme example, but it's what we go through.
No, it's actually absolutely valid. So when I was in prison, I'm a youth offender, and I had one of the things in order to parole was they said, well, go get a vocation. And so I went out and got a vocation. I put in all this time and effort and tax dollars into HVAC, and then I get out, you know, and I'm like, oh, I'll be HVAC. Absolutely not. Parole will not approve it because parole has to approve or deny every job I do. So he said no, even though, you know, the supervisor was not. But this is the weird thing, is in a year or 2 years, I'm going to be off parole. So all you're doing is you're stunting somebody, you know. And, dude, even with you, in a few years, none of this is going to matter. So they're just putting all these – they're not reintegrating us back into society. They're holding us back. They're denying us and depriving us. And then all of a sudden you're gonna it's gonna be open range. So what are they really
remember
doing? Are they educating? Or are they just telling us not to that we can't do nothing? You know, is it a power trip or is
test?
It actually? Huh?
Do you remember the compass test that you took in prison?
Yes.
Okay, so compass test, for those for the listeners who aren't aware of it, a compass test is a test that CDC gives to find out what you need to rehabilitate yourself. Now, the reason they give the test is because it was discovered that if you participate in programs that you don't need, you're hurting yourself. So, for example, if you've never been high a day in your life or never been drunk a day in your life and you start going to AA or NA, and you're doing it, of course, to get the RAT credit so you can get out early, but if you start attending those programs, come to find out you're actually hurting yourself. So they came up with a compass program. And the compass program finds out, what do you need? Well, like you, Sparky, I took a compass test. And my compass test said that, you know, out of all the areas that I had, I was at low risk to reoffend, but I did need to improve them and work on my education. So when I get out, I go to Project Rebound. And Project Rebound is going to continue to try to help me out. I went to Project Rebound, and parole basically told me, no, because it involved, you cannot go to college because it involves access to a computer. Kidding
wow.
me? I cannot educate myself
yeah.
because it involves access to a computer?
But hey, as soon as supervision's yeah. over, you can do whatever you want. I mean, there's no rules or regulations. So, like I said, you know.
Well, there's rules and regulations, but there's no parole. You're right. But
yeah.
Why should I
but
have
you
to
know what I mean.
Have I not waited long enough? I have an opportunity here and now to be a productive member of society, to do something good, to give back, and to keep people from being hurt. Why can I not take
yeah.
advantage of that opportunity while the iron is hot? Why can I not strike while the iron is hot?
Well, I mean, they got to make their money somehow. But we're closing up on a couple minutes here. Sean, you want to give your contact information? I believe you have a GoFundMe.
I do. So if you go to GoFundMe and you look up Sean Perrot, P-E-R-R-O-T, and you look up, it takes a village. There's a lot of them that it takes a village, but there's only one Sean Perrot. If you look at that, I do have a GoFundMe. If you want to donate, you know, there's no amount that's too small. And I have a blog that I kept for years in CDC that got scanned and uploaded. If you ever want to read some of my posts, it's betweenthebars.org/blogs/1451. I encourage you to check it out. There's a lot of people up there, not just myself, but there's a lot of people there that write on a regular basis. And you know what? These people that are doing this, they could use a letter. A letter in the mailbox makes all the difference in the world.
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Sean, for your insight and for your story and for just being your honest struggle. And I really do hope that this helps somebody. Please leave your comments, your questions. You can hit me up at legacyprogram@gmail.com or legacyprogrameducation@gmail.com. I apologize. And please, if anybody wants to keep this thing going, we also have a Cash App at NVO Shedding Light. Please donate to keep the awareness and education going on. And for all my brothers and my sisters out there that are doing time and that are coming home from doing time, bless your souls. If you guys need any help, check us out on legacyprogrammed.net. Leave us your contact information. My direct phone call or phone is hooked up to that. We also have a reentry crisis hotline if anybody wants to, you know, call that. They're having issues. That's 805-621-1176. We are here to help. And for the families that are doing the time with our loved ones, you are strong, you are the rock, and we have to get the support network going and stronger. And I just want to thank everybody for listening. Without the viewers, without the listeners, we could not do this. So I really want to say thank you so much. God bless y'all, and just keep up the good fight, and we will win this eventually. So have a wonderful day. Stay blessed, y'all. Bye, Sean.
Bye. Thank you.